And welcome back to Coast. For the next couple hours, we're going to talk about the ascent of gravity, the quest to understand the force that explains everything. It's an amazing story. Marcus Krohn with us, and we're going to join him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Marcus Chown with us, an award-winning writer and broadcaster, formerly a radio astronomer at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He is currently a cosmology consultant of the weekly science magazine New Science. He is an author of The Solar System, Quantum Theory Cannot Hurt You, The Never-Ending Days of Being Dead, and The Magic Furnace, and his latest work, The Ascent of Gravity. Marcus, welcome to the program. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Looking forward to this. How did you enjoy Pasadena when you were here?
I enjoyed it. I mean, it was I could be in shorts pretty much the whole year round. I'm phoning you here from London, which is colder, so I really enjoyed the climate. I enjoyed the fact that you could drive to somewhere, you could ski, go to the beach, all these kind of things. But I didn't enjoy the smog. It used to be quite smoggy when I was there. I think it's cleared up now.
Well, that's amazing place out there. I had been there visiting some time ago, and they do good work out there, don't they?
Yeah, and of course it's the 100th anniversary, I believe, of the Mount Wilson 100-inch telescope, which of course, as I could see from my kitchen window, it discovered the expansion of the universe and all that kind of stuff. So that was an amazing instrument, the biggest telescope in the world. I mean, that was fantastic to see it from there. And Caltech, you're right, does amazing stuff. It has all these Nobel Prize winners. It's
a
relatively small institute, but it has a great reputation.
You got interested in gravity in what kind of way? Because it's not something everybody would just say, "Hey, I'm going to write a book about this."
I suppose I'm intrigued by the paradoxes. I mean, it's the force that we think was the first to be understood by Isaac Newton in the 1600s. You know, so 300 or 400 years ago, and yet it's the least understood today. You know, it's the weakest force by some tremendous factor. I mean, the electric force, which is holding together the atoms in your body, is 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity. So gravity is fantastically weak. And yet on the very large scale, the scale of planets and stars and galaxies in the universe, it controls everything. So the weakest force is the most powerful on the large scale. And of course, the other thing is that you know, we think of it as a force like a piece of invisible elastic that connects the sun to the earth and keeps the earth going around the sun. But Einstein showed us 100 years ago that in fact that's completely incorrect, and there is no such force as gravity. So the force of gravity does not actually exist.
If we did not have gravity, what would happen? Would everything just go haywire?
Well, basically, we live in a very, very boring universe, because the reason that matter is clumped into interesting things like the sun and the stars and the planets and all that kind of stuff is because of gravity. It's an attractive force. I mean, this is this was Newton's discovery. It's a universal force, so that means it's a force which operates between every chunk of matter and every other chunk of matter. So, you know, we all know that there's a force pulling the moon towards the earth, or the earth towards the sun, but actually it's a universal force, which means there's a force between you and the person that walking past you on the high street, on the street. There's a force between you and the coins in your pocket. It's just that on that scale, the force is quite weak. So, you know, it clumps together all the interesting objects in the universe. There would be no planet Earth if there were no gravity.
And the moon would smash into us, or what would happen with that?
Well, I mean, it would just fly off. Basically, off towards the stars. You know, I mean, this was Newton's genius, because Newton, a man of the 17th century, whose father couldn't even write and signed his name with a cross, recognized that the same force that was pinning his feet to the ground and causing an apple to fall from a tree was the same force that was keeping the moon trapped around the earth. Now that's a stroke of genius, because an apple falls from a tree to the ground, it's not obvious that the moon is falling as well. But Newton recognized that it is falling. It's actually falling in a circle. So his genius was to realize that the earth and the heavens are governed by exactly the same force, exactly the same laws. And that would have been a tremendously brave thing to say in the 17th century, because obviously it was a very religious time, and people believed that the heavens were governed by different forces than the earth. So to say there was just one force that governed terrestrial affairs and celestial affairs was a really brave thing. He was actually an incredibly religious person, and in fact, most of his work was actually analysis of the Bible, and his scientific work was actually only a small portion of his life.
All right, give us your definition that we could understand on what gravity is.
Gravity is an attractive force between every chunk of matter and every other chunk of matter. Okay, so there's an attractive force, as I said, between you and the coins in your pocket, between you and someone on the street, between the sun and the earth. So every single piece of matter, every single piece of mass attracts every other piece with this force. Now, Newton also was able to, by comparing the fall of an apple to the way the moon was moving, he was able to figure out how that force changed with distance. So the force gets weaker the further apart two masses are. And it drops off as what we call an inverse square law. So if you double the distance between two masses, then the force is four times as weak. If you triple it, it's nine times as weak. So he figured that out. So it's a universal attractive force between all bits of matter. And as I said in the beginning, we still don't quite understand what gravity is. Newton described it, but we don't actually know what it is.
What did our old friend Albert Einstein think of gravity?
Well, interestingly, he showed that it didn't exist, the force of gravity. As I said in the beginning, the Newton was thinking that there was this force between, you know, the sun and the earth. Think of it as a piece of invisible tether or something like that, a piece of elastic that connects the earth to the sun and keeps us constrained to go around the sun forever. Einstein realized that that's an illusion. What the sun in fact does is it warps or bends the space-time around it. Now, space-time is not something you can see. It's a higher dimensional thing that you cannot see. So, but the sun actually creates a valley in the space around it. And the Earth rolls around the edge of this valley rather like a roulette ball around a roulette wheel. So actually, there is no force of gravity at all. We're just responding to this hidden warpage of space-time. Now, we can't see it, which is why it took a genius like Einstein to realize. Now, the ultimate proof that this is correct and that space or space-time is actually a thing that can be warped and bent is the discovery made in America on the 14th of September 2015, and that was the discovery of gravitational waves. Because if space-time or space-time is a thing that can be warped, as Einstein told us, it's something that can be rippled as well, just like the surface of a pond. And those ripples are gravitational waves, and they were picked up, as I say, in Hanford, Washington State, and in Louisiana on the 14th of September 2015. And the three of the people that made that discovery won the 2017 Nobel Prize for Physics.
And Marcus, if you were to have two people holding a bed sheet, and somebody dropped a bowling ball in the middle of this bed sheet, and it would kind of like roll down in the bottom and sag the sheet with it. Is that like warping space and time?
Exactly. So say we had a race of ants that lived, say, on a trampoline. Let's say we had a race of ants. They live on the surface of a trampoline. They only know about the surface of the trampoline, so they can't experience above and below the trampoline. And you put a bowling ball on the trampoline. Okay, from our perspective, because we're three-dimensional creatures, we see that it's got a depression that's created. From their perspective, they don't see that at all. They see that if they walk across their trampoline, they appear to be bent towards this bowling ball. And they may think, oh, there's an attractive force. They could not even call it gravity. But, of course, from our perspective, from this higher dimensional perspective, we see there is no such force. All there is, as you just pointed out, is the depression caused by the bowling ball. And that's exactly the way it is with the sun. We think there's a force because our path is bent into an ellipse or a circle around the sun. The Earth's path is bent. But actually, if we could see things from a higher dimensional perspective, we would see that, in fact, that isn't the case. And that the sun is, as you pretty much like a bowling ball that has depressed the space around it.
Is the rule of physics that helps determine, I believe, gravity, is it the same throughout the universe? Are there any surprises out there?
Well, I mean, first of all, should point out that what's so incredible is that Newton, he actually identified a universal force. Okay, so it's a force that applies in all places in the universe.
And he didn't have any instruments to do it with either.
No, at all times. And it was a very, very simple force. So then you have to ask yourself, the universe could be actually constructed in a really complicated way, but it's actually constructed in such a simple way that a man of the 17th century could identify a universal force, that is one that applies in all places and all time. As far as we know, I mean, obviously Einstein has shown that Newton's theory was actually, Newton's theory is an approximation of Einstein, so Einstein got a slightly better picture. But basically, Newton and Einstein's gravity does apply everywhere in the universe, as far as we know. So, and since the discovery by Newton of this universal law, we found other laws which apply all places and all times. Now, of course, we can't go to other bits of the universe to check that the physics is the same. However, we can pick up things like starlight. And starlight has encoded in it information, for instance, about the atoms that produce the light. And we can see that light coming from the most distant objects comes from atoms which are very similar to the ones, or identical to the ones on the Earth. So as far as we do know, the same laws apply in other places as on Earth.
Marcus, if Einstein and Newton got together, what do you think they'd be talking about?
Well, didn't they play chess on Star Trek? wasn't there a Star Trek episode?
I think you're right.
But it was Stephen Hawking. I think he's the only living person, I think, to have appeared on real life person rather than a fictional person to appear on Star Trek.
Right.
He's also appeared on The Simpsons, hasn't he? Didn't he play? I think he played chess with holograms of Newton and Einstein. What would they talk about? I don't know. I mean, Newton pushed science as far as he could in the 17th century. You know, I mean, basically, he explained all he could, all that the instruments of the 17th century could show him. You know, I mean, he even invented the reflecting telescope. I just mentioned the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson in Pasadena, above Pasadena. Well, I mean, Newton was the person who invented the reflecting telescope. So he pushed science as far as he could, and that probably explains why he spent a lot of his life analyzing the Bible. He did alchemy. He was also Marshal of the Mint in London, and he spent a lot of time chasing coin counterfeiters. That was about 25 years of his life. So he pushed science as far as he could. But, I mean, he would be absolutely fascinated to talk with Einstein, because, you know, Einstein effectively told him that his theory was incorrect. So,
What would they argue?
What would they argue about? I suppose by the time we got to Einstein, we knew a lot more about the universe. So, for instance, we knew about stars. In the 19th century, a French philosopher called Auguste Comte made a list of things that we could never know anything about. And one of them was he thought that it would be utterly impossible to ever know what the stars were made of. Within about 10 years of his death, it was discovered that there was a kind of a fingerprint imprinted on starlight, and you could actually work out what the stars were made of. So Newton would not have known what the stars were other suns, for instance. I mean, like our sun is, the stars are like our sun, but they're so far away that they are shrunk to pinpoint. So I think Einstein could have told him about more about the universe than he knew with his 17th century instruments. But of course, even Einstein himself didn't even realize the scale of the universe, because at the time Einstein came up with his theory of gravity, which was the height of the First World War, people did not know whether the Milky Way, which is this kind of band of stars we see across the sky, it seems to be an island of stars that the sun is part of, people didn't know whether that was the whole universe, or whether this band of stars in the Milky Way was just one island among many others. And now we know it's one among 2 trillion others. So although he had a better picture than Newton, he didn't have the picture we have today.
Is gravity of the physical realm, or is it something else?
Well, we obviously assume that everything is the physical realm.
But it doesn't have minute particles controlling it, or does it?
Good question. That is one of the key questions, because we know that Newton's theory was incorrect For instance, his theory effectively says that the gravity acts instantaneously. So, in other words, if the sun were to vanish at this instant, then the Earth would fly off towards the stars immediately. Einstein realized that the speed of light is the ultimate speed. So even gravity cannot travel faster than the speed of light. So light takes 8.5 minutes to get from the sun to the Earth. So Einstein would have said that if the sun were about to vanish at this instant, the Earth would continue orbiting the sun for 8.5 minutes before it realized gravity had gone. So that's
right.
So there's slight differences. Now, we do know that Einstein's theory predicts its own demise. So we know that the universe is expanding at the moment. Its galaxies are flying apart like bits of cosmic shrapnel in the aftermath of the Big Bang. If we kind of run that expansion backwards like a movie in reverse, we come to this moment 13.8 billion years ago when the Big Bang, when everything was concentrated in one point. And in fact, if we extrapolate backwards, we get what we call a singularity. So everything is compressed into an infinite density, infinite temperature. This is rubbish. You know, this is garbage. When you get an infinity in a theory, it tells you your theory is wrong. So we know that Einstein's theory predicts something nonsensical and is wrong. So we're now currently looking for a better, deeper theory of gravity than both Newton's and Einstein's.
Are we going to find that?
We call it quantum gravity moment, and it is the biggest challenge ever to face physics. And we wonder whether, as you point out, since Newton's time, we've discovered there are four fundamental forces that glue all the particles of matter together. There's gravity, there's the electric force that glues together the atoms in your body, and there's two nuclear forces, which we only discovered in the 20th century.
What about magnetism? Does that have a role in it?
Yeah, the electric force, when I talk about electric force, I mean electromagnetism.
Okay.
So that was the force that was understood in the 19th century. Interestingly, it was magnetism that was the model for gravity. So people knew about magnetism at Newton's time, and they understood that if you had like two magnets, there was a force. You could actually feel the force. You know, when you put two magnets together, they either repel each other or they attract each other, and you can actually feel this force in the empty space. So they did wonder whether gravity was something like that. So that was the original model for gravity, came from magnetism. But in the 20th century, we've realized that forces arise because of the exchange of what we call force-carrying particles. So rather like you imagine two tennis players batting a tennis ball backwards and forwards between them, as the ball hits the racket, you know, the one of the tennis players recoils, so that applies a force. So we believe that all the other forces, we have a description of them, in which there is an exchange particle. So for instance, the electromagnetic force, there's the exchange of photons. These are particles of light. So we actually think that gravity may be caused by the exchange of particles called gravitons. No one's ever seen a graviton. But that is the picture, you know. So Newton, for instance, assumed that there could be a force across empty space. We realize now that something has to actually move across empty space to apply that force. So particles, gravitons, may be the explanation of gravity.
They don't teach this in school, Marcus.
They don't, because it's the frontier, because it's the absolute frontier. People have been really struggling to find this theory of gravity, this deeper theory than Newton's and Einstein's, for 50 years. And there are reasons why it's very, very difficult. And we are kind of like groping in the fog to find this better theory. This is the trouble. When you're at the frontier of physics, there aren't any signposts. But one of the interesting things is the discovery of gravitational waves in 2015. These were created by the merger of two giant black holes, and for the first time we see the result of what happens when gravity is extremely strong. And so there is the possibility that in the gravitational waves we pick up, we may see the signature of deeper physics beyond Newton and Einstein. That's always a hope.
Okay, we're going to come back in a moment and talk more with you, Marcus, about your book, The Ascent of Gravity, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Marcus John with us as we talk about his work, The Ascent of Gravity. What breakthroughs, Marcus, will there be in the next 5-10 years about gravity? Do you anticipate anything?
I do. I think we are in an incredibly exciting period. I think that discovery of gravitational waves was really amazing. I mean, to give you some idea, imagine you've been deaf since birth, and then suddenly overnight you can hear. You know, gravitational waves are the voice of space. You know, they're ripples
in the
fabric of space-time. So for all of human history, we've been able to look at the heavens with our eyes and more recently with our telescopes. We've been able to see the light. Now, for the first time, we can actually hear the universe. So if you imagine these first detections, we've now detected about 5 sources in the last 2 years. It's as if we've got an incredibly crude sense of hearing, you know, and just at the very, very edge of audibility, we've picked up this sound, like the sound of distant thunder, that kind of thing. But we're yet to hear, you know, the equivalent of, a bird singing or a baby crying or music or anything like that. So we've got no idea what this cosmic symphony is going to sound like. And if you imagine, before we could actually, we look at the universe now, not just with visible light, which our eyes can see, but we there are other types of light, invisible light, like radio waves, X-rays, all this sort of stuff. And when we've done that, we've discovered all kinds of unexpected things, like black holes and the afterglow of the Big Bang, all kinds of things that we never expected. So with this new sense, I would predict that in the next few years we're going to pick up all kinds of things that nobody ever dreamt of. So this is a really exciting time.
How about CERN in Switzerland and the France border? What do you think they're really doing there?
Well, you mean the Large Hadron Collider?
Yes.
Actually a 27-kilometer, basically underground ring, underground tunnel, around which subatomic particles, protons, are accelerated and they're smashed together to, you know, basically recreate the conditions that existed very early on in the universe and create, basically break apart matter into its constituents. Normally, in any type of science, when you have an instrument which allows you to see further, to see higher energies, to see higher temperatures, whatever, you always discover lots and lots of things you never expected. But oddly enough, the Large Hadron Collider has only discovered what we expected, which was this thing called the Higgs particle. The Higgs is responsible for our mass, the fact that we actually have a mass. And this was predicted in the 1960s. And oddly enough, nothing unexpected so far has turned up. And so the particle physicists are a little bit desperate at the moment because they can't step up the energy of this multi-billion dollar accelerator much more. But they were hoping to find things that they didn't expect. So, for instance, we've discovered that the visible stars and galaxies in our universe are outweighed by a factor of 6 by dark matter. You've probably heard of dark matter. This stuff is...
Well, now they're beginning to think that maybe dark matter and dark energy doesn't exist. There was a story that just came out a couple days ago.
Well, I mean, that is possible. That's not what the physics community believes.
Not overall, no. This
so
was
the main
an individual.
Reason for that is that dark matter and dark energy do fit into their there's a lot of interlocking evidence for these things.
It explains what they can't explain.
Yeah, but the evidence of dark matter comes from several directions, not just from one direction, and so does dark energy. You know, so, it's always possible. It's always possible we're wrong because we are in this amazing state where if dark energy and dark matter are real, then 95% of the universe is invisible. So basically, everything that we've been studying, everything science has been studying since the time of Newton, 350 years, is only a minor contaminant of the universe, kind of like the dusting of snow on a mountaintop. And as you say, we don't actually know what the mountaintop is. We can characterize it. So everywhere we look in the universe, for instance, we see that the visible stars and galaxies are moving in a way that we would not have expected. So, for instance, if you take our galaxy, which is like a giant pinwheel, like a giant spiral of stars, and you look at the stars which are circling around, orbiting in the outer regions, they're moving far too fast. They should be flung outwards, just like kids on a speeded up merry-go-round. They should just flung off. So we can see that they're experiencing stronger gravity than we can account for. And we say that there's a lot of invisible stuff whose extra gravity is gripping onto those stars. So that's one place that we know that we get evidence of dark matter. But we also do know that without dark matter, we wouldn't be here. So after the Big Bang, the material of the universe was very hot. It was very, very evenly distributed, glowing, and very small, little irregularities, places where the matter was slightly denser than anywhere else. And they began to drag in more material with their gravity. And they got stronger and grabbed in more material. It's rather like a process of the rich getting ever richer, that kind of process.
Yeah.
But the truth is that process would take something like 100 billion years to build a galaxy as big as the Milky Way. But the universe has only been around for about 10 billion years. So there hasn't been enough time. So again, from that, we have to postulate the existence of a large amount of invisible stuff whose extra gravity speeded up the formation of galaxies like the Milky Way. So there's two different directions that we're learning that there's dark matter. So in general, if these things don't exist, the problem is that we haven't learned about them we haven't been given the hint from one single direction, but quite a few directions. So that's why it would be quite controversial to say that these things don't exist, although, of course, it's always possible. We've made mistakes in the past. Famously, for hundreds of years up until end of the 19th century, we believed in the ether. You know, that if you imagine sound, we know it's a wave, and it's a ripple in the air around us. And it was discovered in the mid-19th century, or in the early 19th century. Oddly enough, the man who discovered this lived only a mile from where I am in London. It was discovered that light is a wave. Okay, we don't notice it because the distance between the crest is very small, something like a thousandth of a millimeter, so it's not easy to spot that light is a wave. But light is a wave like a ripple on a pond. So immediately people thought, well, what is it a ripple in? It's got to be rippling something.
Right.
So they invented this medium called the ether. And they said this ether is invisible and it fills all of space, and it's the thing that is rippling to create light. But that turned out to be an illusion. It turned out that there is no ether. So it's always possible that dark matter and dark energy are a 21st century ether. It's always possible. But I think it's probably not likely.
If you were able to travel, Marcus, 14.5 billion years, light years away,
yeah,
would you get to the Big Bang?
I know what you're asking, and the answer is yes. But I should just tell you one thing, and that is that the universe expanded actually far faster than light in its first split second. Now, you may think that that's impossible, that Einstein told us that nothing can travel faster than light, but that was actually Einstein's special theory of relativity of 1905. In his general theory of 1915, space itself can travel at any speed it likes. So very, very early on, there's a period we call inflation, that the universe expanded far faster than light. And that means that in the 14 billion years the universe has been around, you know, well, that means that the distance to the edge of the universe is not 14 billion light years. It's actually about 40 billion light years.
40
billion light years.
Jeez.
So much more than you think.
Now, when you say the edge, what's beyond the edge?
Very interesting question. The fact that the universe is born, let's start by saying the fact that the universe was actually born 14 billion years ago and has not existed forever. Now, that is probably one of the most amazing discoveries in the history of science, that the universe was actually born. And the fact that the universe was born means that we can only see the galaxies and stars, that these are the constituents of the universe, we can only see those objects whose light has taken less than 14 billion years to get to us. Okay, objects whose light would take 15 billion years to get to us, well, its light's still on its way, it hasn't arrived yet. So because of that, there is this horizon around the universe, what we call the observable universe. So within this horizon, imagine as this horizon is like the surface of a soap bubble, and we're at the center of it. And within this soap bubble are something like 2 trillion galaxies. Okay, so what's beyond the edge of the soap bubble? What's beyond what we call the light horizon of the universe? Well, that's an interesting question. Turns out there's more of the universe. In exactly the same way as if you were at the sea and you looked at the horizon, you know there's more of the ocean over the horizon.
That's right. You know that.
We know there's more of the universe over the horizon. Okay, so if we wait another year, more of the universe will come over the horizon because we'll be able to see objects further away.
Mm-hmm.
Light that's on its way, currently on its way, will arrive. So if we were to wait another billion years, we'll see a lot more. So the horizon will expand outwards, and we'll see more of the universe.
I just sometimes picture it, Marcus, as a wall at the end. You know, something that just you hit. You can't get through it. But it's not that way, is it?
No. Everybody in the universe is at the center of their own observable universe. So they're at the center of this bubble of stars and galaxies, surrounded by this horizon. But beyond the horizon, there is just more of the universe. Now, according to the standard picture at the moment, which includes this idea of inflation that I mentioned, which is a super fast expansion that went on in the first split second of the universe existence, the universe itself may be infinite in extent. It could be infinite in extent, in which case it just goes on forever. And at the moment, we just see this tiny little bubble, this what we call the observable universe, in the greater universe, which may be infinite. So we actually don't know what is beyond the horizon, but we suspect it's just more stars and galaxies, and the universe could go on forever.
Let's take some calls, and we're going to take calls next hour in your final hour with us, Marcus. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the program, Joseph.
Hey, George. Happy New Year, George.
You too, Joe.
Thank you. And Marcus, Happy New Year to you
all. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you now, concerning gravity, first of all, in cases of levitation or flotation, buoyancy, isn't that a sort of reversal of gravity on Earth? And also, what is the numerical measurement of gravity on Earth, or is it variable?
To answer your last question, I don't know if giving you the number will help very much, but it does vary gravity on the Earth because the Earth is not a sphere, so it rotates, and at the equator, the Earth is rotating at 1,000 miles an hour, so that causes the Earth to bulge slightly at the equator. So you're slightly further away from the center of the Earth. So gravity is slightly weaker, you know, because the further you are from a mass, the weaker gravity. So there is a slight variation over the Earth as well, you know. And if you've got a really sensitive instrument, you could find anomalies in gravity that are caused by, deposits of iron and things like that. In fact, oddly enough, there's a guy called Robert Forward who used to be the a scientist at Hughes Research Labs in Malibu, and he patented the only device which actually uses Einstein's theory of gravity. And it's these spinning masses that you take in an aeroplane, and it detects the curvature of space-time caused by mass and allows you to, I believe, detect hidden deposits of minerals under the Earth's surface. What was the first part of your question? Because it's gone.
Go ahead, Joe.
My mind.
The first one was concerning levitation or cases of buoyancy or flotation. Isn't that a sort of, albeit a temporary, reversal of gravity on Earth?
It's something that nullifies gravity, but gravity is still there. But I can tell you something which you perhaps don't actually realize, and that is actually, although gravity is an attractive force, most of the stuff in the universe actually repels with gravity. George mentioned dark energy, which basically was discovered in 1998. We've discovered that the galaxies, which were flying apart in the aftermath of the Big Bang, we thought they should be slowing down their expansion because the gravity between them should be slowing them down. We found they were speeding up, so we had to postulate the existence of this dark energy. And this dark energy is invisible, fills all the space, and has got repulsive gravity. And its repulsive gravity is speeding up the expansion of the universe. And this dark energy accounts for two-thirds of the mass of the universe. So actually, when you're at high school and they tell you that gravity is an attractive force, they're behind the times, because actually most of the stuff in the universe actually has repulsive gravity.
gravitational pulls on tidal waves. How does that happen?
You mean tides?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very interesting...
And primarily from the moon, right?
That's right. Well, actually, yeah, two-thirds of the tides come from of the effect comes from the moon, and one-third from the sun. So even if we didn't have the moon, we'd still have
tides. And it's only at night, isn't it?
No, or day and night. That's a fascinating question, because here you see the power of science. Okay, now if you go back to like the Babylonians or whatever, they noticed things like the motion of the stars, and they could predict eclipses and all that sort of stuff, you know, because they noticed the patterns. But the difference is that science explains the patterns. So Newton was able to find out, we could see the pattern in the motion of the planets, you know, they all went around the sun in a particular time and whatever. But Newton found the law that was beneath the pattern, that created the pattern. And if you have the law, the basic fundamental law, you can apply it in other places. So Newton applies this law of gravity, which he deduces from observing the moon and the planets, and he applies it to things like the ocean tides. So for millennia, people have wondered why there are two tides a day. You know, what are the tides about? And what Newton realized is that the tides are caused by differences in gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine the ocean facing the moon, so the moon is above the ocean, the force of gravity gets weaker with distance. So the force of gravity on the surface of the ocean is slightly stronger than it is at the seabed.
Marcus, we're coming back with final questions for you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.